Jamil Zainchef joins me for another brewing question and answer session. This is Beersmith Podcast number 281.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 281, and it's late May 2023. Jamil Zainchef joins me this week for a question and answer session. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith brewing software. Beersmith for the web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as the full suite of recipe building tools that our desktop version has. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to smash the like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on, as it really helps us in many ways. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Jamil Zainchef. Jamil is an award-winning professional brewer and home brewer. He's authored the books Brewing Classic Styles, The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation, and he's also co-host of Brew Strong podcast on the Brewing Network. Jamil, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Brad.
It's a pleasure. Absolutely. We always enjoy having you here. It's been almost a year since we last chatted, if you can believe that.
Gosh, when you said that, I couldn't believe how time flies.
Well, are you enjoying semi-retirement now?
Huh? Yeah, I'm semi-enjoying semi-retirement. Yeah.
You mentioned you still have several projects going on. I think a couple books or something.
Yeah, there's lots of books to write still. I've been homebrewing a little bit, brewing some classic British ales to serve in my friend's garage pub. And fixing things around the house, which I really enjoy. I like to see, you know, the results of work, and home repairs usually go pretty quick. So that's been a joy.
Really? Mine always take 3 or 4 trips to Home Depot. I don't know about you, but
yeah, that happens too.
Well, before we get started, I want to ask you, so if you're homebrewing again, what are you brewing on? What kind of system do you have?
My good friend, Chris Graham from More Beer, he gave me a Brewzilla.
All-in-one system.
Yeah. And I'm surprised at how easy and convenient it is and how it stores in a small location. It doesn't take up a lot of room and it's super easy to use. So I really like it. And you know, like I said, I've been brewing mainly British ales, so nothing really high gravity. And the quality's been fantastic, so I'm real happy with it. He was like, "If you're gonna homebrew here, I'll give you one of these."
I have a 10-gallon system, but I've been tempted to get one of those small all-in-one systems just to be able to brew smaller batches, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, just super convenient. It's one vessel, and you do everything in the one vessel. So, and it's got a pump. It's got, you know, heater control. It's got, you know, you can recirculate. You can, you know, throw a chiller in there. Super easy. I really like it.
Nice. Well, today I wanted to do another Q&A session. So I thought I might start by asking you a bit about how homebrewing as a hobby has evolved over your long career. And you've been brewing quite a long time, if I recall.
Yeah, you know, the thing with homebrewing is it's become a lot more technical over time, which I guess is to be expected. And, you know, the ingredients we have today, I remember when I started, you know, it was the only information was books, magazines, and then there was a, you know, bulletin board that you could, you know, dial up on your modem and get into the bulletin board.
That's and right. Yeah.
And I remember a lot of the advice back then was, you know, just really weird, weird old school advice. And, you know, now today it is people are using, you know, just they have access to bioengineered yeasts. They have, you know, new hop products that, you know, were designed for the pros, but, you know, are also available in your homebrew shop. They have, you know, all sorts of ingredients that we never had before. Yeah, that's kind of why I want to do an update to Brewing Classic Styles, is because all the ingredients have really changed. And, you know, homebrewers have gotten so technical now that, you know, a lot of them are more technical than the commercial craft brewers. Commercial craft brewers, they don't have time to study every last little, invention, whereas people that homebrew are really doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I've been surprised a lot of homebrewers, for example, spend more time on their water than the pros do.
Oh, absolutely. Water, hops, you know, it's mash schedules. They want to control everything to, you know, the nth degree. It's surprising how detailed and technical homebrewing has become.
One of the things I noted back when you and I started, it was the early internet. And one of the challenges is the people that dominated the conversation at that time when we were developing really a lot of the homebrewing and even pro brewing technology were scientists and engineers. So they kind of dominated the whole discussion back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they still are today.
Yeah, so that's one of my things. So I don't know if you ever see my designing beer presentation, but I often do a slide at the front where I talk about, you know, some of the because of beer brewing has become so technical, even at the homebrew level, it's sort of hidden some of the artistic elements, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I don't know if you feel the same way, but
yeah, I think, you know, there's a need for the technical, but you know, a lot of the fun, and that is a lot of fun for a lot of people, you know, me included. But, you know, sometimes it's nice to see some, you know, some artistry or some just, you know, crazy thinking type of
process. I like some of the beers that are built around a particular flavor, you know, maybe an unusual flavor, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or ingredient or something. Anyway, so I thought I'd start today with a few of the trends in craft brewing. And one of the ones we're seeing, at least in the last couple of years, is a move towards continental style lagers and sort of a resurgence of things like Czech style pilsners. What advice do you have for those looking to make maybe the perfect pilsner or a continental lager at home?
Well, I just recently was down at Disneyland for May the 4th and stopped in to see my good friend Rick at Stereo Brewing. They're real close there. If you're ever down Disneyland area, you need to go to Stereo Brewing and check him out. He's a great brewer, and you know, every beer on there was perfect, you know, just super well done. But the one that blew my mind was his Czech style pilsner. And it tasted like the best Czech pilsners of the world. And it was better than any Czech pilsner I've ever had. Other than, you know, the classic historical, you know, breweries. It was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, the way that he made it was, one, you know, the quality of ingredients. So he was using Weirmann floor malted Bohemian Pilsner malt. Mm-hmm. And man, the flavor of that malt was fantastic. When you're making these styles of beer, you know, the ingredients really shine through. And so you need to be choosing the high quality ingredients. Weirmann did just a brilliant job on that malt. It really tastes fantastic. So, the malt, so it, his recipe is Bohemian, you know, the floor malted Bohemian Pilsner malt from Fireman, and then some Czech Saaz hops, mm-hmm. and yeast, water, right?
So very very traditional recipe, right?
Yes, quality hops, you know, great fermentation, and you know that's the trick.
Yeah, I was going to say where the magic's done is really in the process, trying to get all those flaws out, if you will, because anything in a Pilsner is going to show up, you know, is a big problem.
Especially on a beer like that. And he did a masterful job of it. Again, he's just a fantastic brewer and really knows his stuff. And I wish that beer was available all across the U.S. or all across the world, if people could easily get it. It's that good. Wow. Really that good.
That's awesome. So, I mean, are there any things we can do, you know, at the homebrew level to get something close to that, maybe?
Yeah, you know, source high-quality ingredients. So, the proper malt, the proper hops, use, you know, proper yeast. I would, you know, suggest using something, you know, that is a, you know, a Czech lager yeast from any of the major, you know, yeast producers, and, you know, watch your fermentation, you know, start your fermentation low and raise it up as you go. You will need temperature control fermentation. Don't try and do this with Kvike yeast. Yeah. It's just, you're just going to ruin the good ingredients with, you know, something that is not going to be a lager. Don't try fermenting it hot with lager yeast and then cooling it down. That doesn't really work either.
Yeah.
You know, just go with traditional methods. If you're trying to make a world classic, it developed, you know, how it did for a certain way. And you're going to want to stick with those techniques.
Mm-hmm. Well, another trend is towards low alcohol and no alcohol beers in the craft beer industry. Yeah. In particular, we're seeing some innovative work done with new yeasts and techniques that really avoid the traditional process where you might, you know, brew a beer and then try and boil the alcohol out of it, if you will. So what are your thoughts on, you know, some of the non-alcoholic beer coming out and also how it's made?
Yeah, when I was at Heretic, we looked at all the methods of making non-alcoholic or, you know, zero alcohol or, you know, below 0.5, yeah. And then, you know, low alcohol beers. And it's interesting because every supplier looks at the problem from their point of view, right?
Mm-hmm.
So equipment manufacturers, you know, people that make stills, they were making vacuum stills to vacuum off the alcohol without heating the beer up too much.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were people who used essentially reverse osmosis, a special membrane filtration to filter the alcohol out. I thought that was actually the best method. Mm-hmm. You end up with beer without alcohol, and then you end up with just plain alcohol that you can use for other stuff like seltzers. You can actually buy those membranes yourself.
Yeah.
I looked into that. They're not cheap, but you put high enough pressure, you could probably make it work as a homebrewer. I'm sure there's enterprising homebrewers who want to do that. and then, you know, the malt suppliers, for example, Munton's, they sent me some tests of malt extract that you essentially mixed in with water, and it was a non-alcoholic beer already. You hopped it, or you added a little bit of what we would do was take one of our higher alcohol beers because there's more esters to it,
mm-hmm.
and we would take a double IPA and mix just enough of that with the malt extract to bring it up to 0.5 ABV. So it was still considered non-alcoholic, but you got some of the flavors of fermentation And that actually worked quite well also. So that's another method of making it, again, based on the malt supplier end of things. And now you also see the yeast suppliers getting in on the game. Lallemand has a really good low alcohol yeast, and it doesn't ferment maltose, maltotriose, or any of the longer chain sugars. It just ferments, I think, glucose, maybe fructose. I don't know. I would imagine it would do fructose too. And so, since that's a very low portion of the sugars in a mash, you get and also you mash really high mash temperature, you get more complex sugars and less simple sugars, and then you ferment it with this, and it's less than 15% of the sugars in a typical mash is fermentable with this yeast. So you get a fairly low alcohol beer, and you can get it below the 0.5 if you are careful about how high you're going. You can also water it back. So you can take, you could brew an intensely flavorful beer at a higher alcohol. I used to do this with our robust porter and just add water to it. And I'd pour myself, a half or three quarter glass of water and then top it up with the robust porter. And you can use carbonated water to do that. But that tastes good too. So a lot of different methods for doing it. I would say the best for a homebrewer currently is the quickest and simplest, just add some keep some ice cold, carbonated water on hand and mix that with beer, and that gets you lower alcohol beer. The second would be, brew something using the Lallemand low alcohol yeast, LA1, I think it's called, LA for low alcohol.
I personally tried a couple of the European yeast suppliers, low alcoholic beer. It was actually quite good. It wasn't bad at all, And it was made using the low alcohol yeast you mentioned.
Because it's fermented. And, one of the things, you can't just take plain malt extract and not have some fermentation character in there. It just seems kind of flat and weird. So, again, if you're using the malt extract, add, some beer to it. And actually tastes pretty good. I kind of enjoyed the results of the Muttons tests. I thought that they were onto something there. Mm-hmm. And then if you've got a lot of money and space for it, you could go with the vacuum distillation or the membrane, the osmosis technique.
Well, let's switch to one more. One of the most popular styles, of course, is the hazy IPA. How do you get the haze into the hazy IPA? Or the classic.
That's interesting. I worked on it for about 2 years to get a truly permanent haze in one of our beers. When we started out, we just started following everybody else and used everybody else's advice on what we heard from various people around the internet how to make a hazy. And what we had was, a nice beer that was hazy, but a lot of it would drop out. And eventually, if you left it long enough, we would do haze tests in the cold box. We'd have the cones and checking for, how different tests were coming clear. But, over the course of several months, that beer would be almost perfectly clear.
Yeah.
And, a bunch of sludge in the bottom of the can. So that was unacceptable. And so I started working on really understanding where the haze comes from, what makes it permanent. So it's a combination of things. And it's surprisingly the common problem, because one thing about the hazy beers, if there's a bunch of sludge in there and you can taste particles and there's, hop burn from ingesting actual hop material, you don't have a good beer. If you're drinking, you know, a glass of yeast that hasn't settled out, you're not drinking a good beer. That's garbage. That's why people hated hazy IPAs. And some people still hate hazy IPA because of there's so many bad examples. But what you want is a permanent haze. You want the yeast to have settled out. You want, you know, all the hot material to have dropped out as well. At Heretic, we actually centrifuged the beers, our hazy beers. And they're quite hazy even after that. But we would get all the yeast out and all that other material that you don't want to drink.
So what's the secret then? How are you getting the haze in there?
Right. So the one thing is that we found out is most people are overdoing it with wheat and oats. So, and, you know, we were doing the same thing. It's like, well, all right, it needs to be more, you know, add more of the haze causing things, because then you'll get more haze. Right. Isn't that what everybody thinks? The problem is wheat and oats, the glucan in it will act as a clarifier and will cause the haze to drop out of the beer.
Huh.
So you want to keep yourself to about 20% total. So
that's still a good percentage. Obviously.
It's still a good percentage, but if you exceed that, you are going to start having the glucan drop your haze out. Mm-hmm. The other thing I did was I switched. So they actually make some wheat malts that are much higher in protein, and certain proteins contribute to the permanent haze. What is it, hordein or something like that? And there's certain growers that make a specific real high protein wheat. And the idea is the higher the protein, the better the ratio between protein and the glucans. So let's say you have X amount of glucan and, you know, X amount of protein. Well, if you can get the protein higher, then it's like you're adding less glucan and you can get more of the haze forming proteins without clarifying the beer. So that is a brewer out, or a grower. There's a grower up in Oregon or Washington that makes malt that's a lot of people use. I think it's something crazy like, well, it's like 15 or 16%. But what I found instead, you know, much more readily available and really close to the same specs was spelt. So spelt is essentially wheat. So we started using spelt in our beer. We replaced, you know, about half the wheat with spelt, and that made a big difference. And we lowered the total amount of wheat and oats. We used flaked oats and spelt and regular malted wheat. And then the other thing was yeast selection. The yeast that I really loved for hazies is the Imperial Juice yeast. I think that's a great yeast. The thing is to get it to ferment, because we made a lot of higher ABV beers. We made Fourth of Juicy, which I think was 14% juicy. Wow. Or hazy. And the problem with a lot of the hazy yeasts is that they're based off of, I think, British strains, which are typically lower attenuators. And they tend not to brew really high alcohol beers in Britain. So
right. So I mean, the yeast is going to max out, right?
Yeah. What you need to do is give it a lot of oxygen. So you give it a lot of oxygen at the beginning. Then people trying to get, you know, 20 parts per million in dissolved oxygen in their work to start. I think you can give it a dose at the beginning. You give it a dose, you know, later on if you want to really, 8 to 12 hours later.
Yeah, I've seen people use that with meads and wines too. You hit it 12 hours later with another dose. Yeah,
exactly. And that yeast particularly needs a lot of oxygen. And a lot of the British yeast, it goes back to how they used to do the double drop, where they would drop the beer through a sintered pipe to entrain a lot more air into the beer as it dropped into the next fermenter, which was, you know, Yorkshire Square or something like that. And the yeast really need a lot of oxygen. It also helps with some of the ester production later on.
Mm-hmm. And then are you doing things on the hop side as well? Because obviously hops play a role as well in getting the haze.
So, on hops, there's no boil additions. You don't need them.
Right.
Your bittering is going to come from your dry hopping mainly. But we would do a whirlpool addition. We'd lower the temperature of the whirlpool down to about 175 Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And then add the hop addition there. That addition is where you're going to add all your linalool and geraniol high hops.
Right. That's what you want to try and get the biotransformations during fermentation, right?
Uh-huh. So you need a yeast that will do biotransformation. You add the linalool geraniol concentrated hops in your whirlpool, extract that out. You leave the hop matter behind because you don't want that in your beer. You don't want to throw hops in during fermentation. It really, we did blind taste tests with a lot of people, and everyone always preferred the non-fermentation hopped beer. They all preferred the beer that was dry hopped after fermentation. Dry hopping during fermentation, it adds an unpleasant bitterness to the beer, unpleasant character from leaving the hop matter in and stirring the hop matter around for so long that it becomes unpleasant. So we stopped doing that and returned to dry hopping after fermentation, which also helps with harvesting your yeast. The other thing we would do is we would throw all the dry hops in and then pump the beer around for about 3 hours. This was on a 147 barrel U.S. barrel fermenter, 120 barrel net. Mm-hmm. We would pump the beer around for about 3 hours, and that was dry hopping. And once that's done, we let it settle and take the beer and move it over a centrifuge, and it was good to go. So don't dry hop for long periods of time. That's not good for your hazies. You want kind of a fruity, soft character to the hazies. And then the other thing was water. So water, your sulfate to chloride ratio. You want a lot of chloride. I ended up adding, kosher salt to the beer. So we'd go through quite a bit of salt. It adds to the softness and makes your water ratios closer to what you're looking for.
So, I mean, that reduces your sulfate to chloride ratio, making it a little more mild, right?
Yeah, more chloride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because normally with an IPA, you'd be going the other way probably, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with all those changes, you should get something that remains hazy permanently. So we, like I said, we could centrifuge. And normally you can centrifuge a beer quite clear.
Right.
But we could centrifuge this thing to where it's still quite hazy. You removed all the yeast. You removed all the hop matter. So it drinks, smooth and deliciously. And it would stay hazy permanently. I mean, after a few years, I'm sure, a bit will drop out, but you could go 6 months, a year, and pour that beer and it would still be hazy.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you. That was, I learned some new things there. I appreciate it. Anyways, next question. You wrote the book, Brewing Classic Styles, and you brewed all the styles, basically. The question was, which styles were most challenging to make at home?
Well, at home, I think the most challenging ones are the ones that required a long-term storage for development of flavor.
Yeah.
Mainly the, the barrel-aged sours.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about those is time and temperature, the conditions, the amount of oxygen that's getting permeating through the wood or whatever vessel you're using make a difference in the final flavor of the beer. So it's pretty critical. And if you're storing something like this for, 3 or 4 years, you're finding out whether it worked out or not can be tricky. When I was at Heretic, we had a barrel program there. At one point, I think we had about 500 wine barrels filled with various sours and, a sour base that we worked with. And you'd be shocked, same maker of barrel from the same winery, in a rack, next to each other and, filled at the same time from the same beer that we had brewed, and one tastes absolutely fantastic and one tastes like garbage.
Yeah.
And, the only way we could put out really great product was we actually had a person that his job was to taste all the barrels and make notes. Mm-hmm. And he would come in and taste through as many as he could. Maybe, the next day, same thing. And the thing was, because we had so many barrels, we were able to just drop, if something didn't taste good, we just dumped it.
The other thing, I've talked with Michael Tonsmeyer about this quite a bit, but most of the programs that people that have a large barrel age program do a lot of blending.
Yes. Well, the thing about blending is if something doesn't taste good, blending it in with beer that does taste good just makes the stuff that tastes good not taste good.
Right, right.
It reduces the quality of you have a barrel that's absolutely fantastic and, you love it. Well, why would you blend in something that doesn't taste nearly as good just to avoid throwing it away? My method was always, if it doesn't taste good, just throw it away. And if you stick with that, then the blend that you're going to make is always going to taste fantastic. If you're only blending fantastic tasting beers, you're only going to get fantastic tasting out of it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we would just throw it away. There's no, you can't save, garbage and mix it in. Garbage in, garbage out. So we're very, very strict on that. And that's why I had so many barrels, because I knew that, a percentage of them wouldn't work. And if a barrel didn't work, generally it meant that it was, if they were the barrels on the ends of the racks versus the barrels in the middle of the stacks have different environmental conditions, and that makes a difference. But, generally you get a couple barrels sitting next to each other and one doesn't taste right. You pull that barrel out of the program. It ends up give it away to home brewers or people making planters. Or one guy took a bunch of our barrels and made Adirondack chairs out of them.
Oh, nice!
And he gave me a set of them and a little table. It's really, really sweet. It was a really nice.
That sounds awesome. Well, cool. Related to this closely, I guess, how important is judging beer as a skill to develop as a brewer? you know, we've often heard that great beer judges make great brewers, but what's your experience with that?
I don't think that's true at all.
No?
there's great beer judges out there, but they do not make good beer. Mm. There's great, you know, I don't know, singers out there who don't paint very well, or, you know, you see that in many walks of life. But yeah, I think if you're a good brewer, honing your judging skills will only help you.
Right.
It really is a fantastic skill to have. And I think it limits your ability as a brewer if you are not a good judge of beer. So you have to be critical of your own beers. You have to, you know, really be able to find what's wrong with your beer and what's right with your beer. You need to be honest with yourself. Too many people, I'm sure you've experienced this, you know, they run up to you with, you know, their best beer ever, and, you know, it's an obvious flaw, and they can't taste it. You know, they just, you know,
I've run into it at the professional level. I go into a brewery and I can taste an obvious flaw in the beer, and I almost, you know, feel like walking up to the brewer and talking to him, but usually I don't, you know.
Right, right. and they don't taste it. And you point it out, they're just like, what? No. It's like, so, you know, it's tough. That's one of the beauties of competition is, you know, they don't know whose beer it is. And so you get a little more honest feedback. I think that's important. But, you know, learning to judge is really good. But again, I think if you're a great judge, that does not mean you're going to be a great brewer.
Mm-hmm.
But a great brewer that is a great judge, that's a powerful combination. Or I think it's hard to be a great brewer without being a great judge, without being able to taste these things.
Awesome. Well, this question is very closely related to our discussion at the beginning of the show, but we spent a lot of time talking about technical aspects of brewing. But how much of beer brewing is art?
Well, I think it can be a lot, but you have to first master the technical aspects of brewing, I think. Mm-hmm. Brewing should be fun.
Yeah.
And if that is just slapping together ingredients and not worrying about it, yeah. And if you like the result, then that's perfect. You don't need to do more. You just need to enjoy brewing, sharing the beer with your friends, you know, relax, you know, have fun, you know, drink a homebrew. You know, you don't need to master the technical if you know, you need some technical, but I think if you really want to get the most out of the artistic side of brewing, you have to first really be a very solid, you know, with all your technical aspects of brewing. You need to be able to repeat, you know, your process and things like that. And then the artistic things that you come up with will have more meaning, will turn out better.
More impact, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. If you're just throwing out, you know, artistic ideas, you know, they may be the greatest ideas in the world, but they're going to fail if there's not solid brewing underneath them. So make sure you can, you know, I always encourage people to, you know, brew the traditional styles, the classic styles, you know, from a known recipe that produces great results. And, you know, once you do that, you know, and you have success with that, then is when you start, you know, coloring outside the box. You know, that's when you start, you know, bringing your own flair to things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've often encouraged people to get used to or get familiar with the flavors too, as well, you know,
mm-hmm.
like the ingredient flavors. A lot of people, you know, don't know the difference between one hop and the other, for example.
Right. I think, you know, one of the best ways to become more familiar with the flavors is to do the smash beers, you know, single yep. malt, single hop.
Single hop, single malt is what, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Single malt, yeah, it's the single hop. Yeah. smash beers, they call them. And you do that, and let's say, you know, you get used to that, then you can, you know, add, you know, something like a Crystal 40 and see how that beer has changed. And once you get used to those flavors, also, you know, taste and chew some of the ingredients. You know, sniff your hops, sniff your malt, your specialty grains, taste some of the grains.
Well, they have this, you've probably seen it, I'm sure, the new ASBC method for doing sensory analysis on malt, where you make a little tea out of the malt. It's actually very effective for getting an idea of what the malt flavor might be.
Absolutely. That's a great method as well.
Great thing for a club to do or something like that.
Yeah. And you can do that. And if you've done a smash beer to compare it to, then, you know, once you've got that, you go, okay, this is what this specialty malt tastes like in a beer. This is what it tastes like in a tea. And then when you do the other teas, let's say, you know, Crystal 10, Crystal 80, and Crystal 120, go, oh, okay, now I'm getting more of a sense of how that'll play out in a beer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you experimented and built beers around a maybe unusual ingredient flavor? I know there's a lot of interesting stuff coming out of South America, for example.
Yeah, not a lot. I mean, single ingredient, usually. You know,
spices,
multiple ingredients, you know, but, I did a really nice, matcha tea IPA.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, you know, matcha tea and, you know, in an IPA. I thought that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, you know, the color, you know, the haze, and just that tea character is great. And then, used a lot of woods, you know, some of the woods that are available now from South America, you know, have some really interesting spicy characters to them.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, you know, single ingredient, no, you know, generally multiple ingredients. And the reason being, you know, to add a, you know, a layer of complexity to those beers.
Mm-hmm. Have you built a lot of beers around spices or fruits?
Yeah, a fair amount. Especially, you know, in our sour program, we did a lot of different fruits. We did some spices. Yeah, it's really fun to work with spices and fruits, and you know, it's a bit more like cooking, and you know, it really makes a dramatic change in beers, and you'd be surprised, you know, playing around with, you know, some of your favorite food flavors and how they can marry up in beers. That's a really fun way of going about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about high alcohol beers. Now, they can be a real challenge because you get, first of all, you get a lot of times low efficiency out of the mash, but then you also have, as you mentioned earlier, long age times with a lot of them. Do you have advice for brewers looking to jump into the higher gravity styles? And I know this is something you've done a lot commercially.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to, you know, certain beers, you know, you're making barley wines or things like that. You know, aging time is nice. You can see how the beer, you know, changes over time. You know, old ale. I just recently brewed Gale's Prize Old Ale in England. You know, that's a beer that, you know, can age for a long time and really changes in complexity, as time goes on. The thing though about high alcohol beers is they shouldn't need long aging if it's not, you know, part of the style. For example, at Heretic, we made an 18% IPA called Whale Juice.
Wow.
And, you know, we every year made an Evil 3, that beer with Mitch Steele and Tasty McDowell and myself, that was 11.5%. And, you know, those ferment and are ready just like any other beer, a beer that's, you know, 4%. And that's based off of, you know, good fermentation practices. healthy yeast, proper temperature control, and a wort that can ferment to those high degrees. So, when you're making something like an 18% IPA, what you're going to do is, build a high gravity IPA to start with. When we did our Evil 3, it was all malt. There was, I don't think we added sugar, dextrose at all, and we added a little bit of dextrose. But you do an all malt beer if you bring something real high gravity. Ferment that out using your yeast and a good pitch of yeast and nice healthy ferment. Get that thing to attenuate, eat all the maltotriose that's in there, and then start dosing with dextrose. Mm-hmm. And the dextrose will ferment out easily. Be careful. You don't want to dump in a bunch of dextrose that won't ferment. So you dose it each day with as much as the yeast can take that day. You can add some nutrients. You can even add oxygen. And slowly bring the ABV up. And with that technique, similar technique that, Dogfish use on their 120, I think it is. And I think Sam Adams used on their Utopias as well. Mm-hmm. You can bring a beer up to about 25% doing that.
Wow. So you could, so you're basically just adding sugar at the end to try and drive the ABV up, huh?
Yes. Yeah. Use dextrose. Don't use cane sugar or beet sugar or anything like that. The flavor of those when they ferment is not as pleasant as dextrose. Dextrose is much better sugar to use for beer brewing. You can chase the ABV up.
That gets around a lot of the problems with, really big mashes, for example, right?
Right. Yeah. You still want to do as big a mash as you can. You want to get all your malt flavors and all that in there as high as possible, and you want that to fully attenuate, and then start adding your sugars. If you do it all at once, the yeast will consume the simple sugars, and then really not consume as much of the maltose. And you end up with a kind of a very under attenuated character to the beer. The other issue is, as you're doing this, if you add too much of the dextrose, you have to kind of read the yeast and see where it's slowing down and when it's getting tired. Mm-hmm. And if you can add another dose of dextrose, I've tasted some other commercial examples where, the brewers just kept going and the thing ends up sickly sweet. So you have to be careful and stop. And you want to leave as dry a character as possible, so the beer tastes like, IPA or something like that.
And of course that has a lot to do with the alcohol tolerance for the yeast you're starting with, right?
Yeah. We did, whale juice with 001, the White Labs, I think they list the alcohol tolerance on that as like 10% or something, but almost every yeast around will do at least 15%. Most of them can be pushed to 18% fairly easy. You've just got to give them the right conditions. So 01 to 18%.
Wow. That's awesome.
I think Chris White was maybe surprised about that one too.
Well, you're feeding it sugar, obviously, so that's different, but.
Right. Yeah. Yeasts do have different alcohol tolerances, but you could use a different yeast if you really want to push it up. There's, some yeasts that'll do, like I said, 25%. We like the character of the 001 yeast, so stuck with that.
So homebrewing's been in decline for about 10 years now in terms of total numbers. Where do you see homebrewing go in the future? Is it going to increase? Is it going to decline further? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like maybe a lot of the homebrewers have gone over to professional brewing because the number of professional breweries has really increased. I don't think that explains all of the missing homebrewers, but I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is how technical homebrewing has become.
Yeah.
And I think the way that homebrewing really, you know, took off and became, you know, such a trend was, you know, the work of Charlie Papazian, where he was, you know, telling people to relax and it's fun and just have a homebrew. And he was right. And that's what really gets people in. When people are faced with, you know, buying masses of stainless steel and learning, you know, calculations and, you know, dealing with, you know, water adjustments and all this stuff, it kind of makes the barrier to entry really high. And I think that that's the problem we have now, is too many people are talking about how technical homebrewing is, when it could be simple and easy. With the Brewzilla that Chris Graham gave from More Beer, I, you know, the first beer I did on it, I didn't bother really, you know, I just said, yeah, you know, like 8 pounds of you know, base malt and a pound of crystal and a, you know, a dash of roast, and that was it. I didn't check gravities. I didn't do anything. I kind of paid attention to the times. I just took it really easy, and I loved it. And it was so much fun and so simple. And that's, you know, I think if other people saw that, they'd go, oh, I can just buy this one piece of equipment, and that's pretty much all I need. It's like, yep, that's all you need. And I think we'd get a lot more people into homebrewing. And, you know, a number of those would love it, really want to take it technical, which is great. But we need to make sure that we're furthering the, you know, the just the simplicity of homebrewing, the joy of homebrewing. You know, some malt extract on the stove with some friends while you're having pizza, you know, that is a fun time. And if we remember, you know, those roots of homebrewing, I think homebrewing could grow again, and it will. But if we all just keep going down the road of it being super technical, and you know, I'm a big part to blame for that too. But I'd like to remind everybody that, you know, homebrewing is actually super easy and super simple. It's easier than baking a cake in some instances. So let's do that, and homebrewing will continue to thrive.
And then I guess the last question I had was, you know, how do you feel about professional brewing? It's obviously, we topped over 9,000 not too long ago. Craft breweries, are they going to peak at some point? I mean, is this thing just going to continue to grow forever?
I don't know. I mean, there is a chance that, you know, we end up with, you know, 20 or 30,000 breweries in the U.S. and they'll all be really small.
Yeah.
Places that, you know, in a way are too small, and will struggle, you know, every day to make a business of it. You know, something will settle out one way or another. I think, you know, the days of, you know, bigger regional breweries is kind of, you know, done. And we'll see. One of the things that kind of concerns me is, and I think it was more when breweries were growing really fast and there was a lot of expansion in craft brewing, we saw a lot of people entering in, and even some people have been around a long time, not be, you know, craft beer and home brewing and commercial brewing was a very communal thing, a very sharing and kind industry,
right,
where everybody helped everybody. And, you know, if you didn't help everybody, you know, something was wrong with you. And, you know, it was you know, when people would come to Heretic, they needed cans, we'd give them cans. If they needed a malt, we'd give them malt. And, you know, sometimes we go back to those people and say, hey, you know, can you help us out? We're short a sack of, you know, this or that. And everybody helped and everybody shared information. Well, when the growth was really upon us, there were a lot of people getting in and they were not part of that group. They wouldn't share. They didn't, yeah. You know, it became more contentious and unpleasant. Then, you know, the pandemic hit and, you know, things kind of crashed, and then people became insular. And then after that has passed, you know, it's a really weird market and everybody's suffering, but you see some of the people kind of getting back together again and helping each other out. And I want to see that continue. I think without that, it's not craft beer. It doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the whole industry can go ahead and die. If that's the way it's going to be. You need to, we all need to help each other. You know, rising tide lifts all boats. We need to, you know, work together to, you know, help homebrewers. Professional brewers should be helping homebrewers, not fighting with them or arguing that they're somehow unpleasant. You know, homebrewers should be helping craft brewers and help promoting them. You know, we all should be working together, and we'll be stronger if we do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there will be more opportunities for everyone. There'll be better beer for everyone. There'll be better ingredients and better, you know, inventions in, you know, homebrewing equipment, professional brewing equipment, ingredients. You know, we'll continue to see this thing grow and improve, but not if we don't work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jamil, really appreciate you being on the show today. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day to be here.
Hey. I love chatting with you, Brad.
It's always a pleasure. My guest today was Jamil Zainishev. He's author of Brewing Classic Styles and The Practical Guide to Fermentation, and of course, a professional brewer and podcaster as well. Thank you again, Jamil.
Take care, brother.
A big thank you to Jamil Zainishev for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or your phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as a full suite of recipe building tools that our desktop version has. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. Again, that's beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to smash the like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening to. It helps us in many ways when you click on that button. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.